Books on Tape presents Nefertiti by Michelle Moran, read by Cassandra Campbell. To speak the name of the dead is to make them live again. Egyptian proverb. Author's note. It has been a long journey for me into Nefertiti's ancient world, a journey that began with a visit to the Altes Museum in Berlin, where her iconic bust is housed. The bust itself has a long and detailed history, beginning with its creation in the city of Amarna and continuing to its arrival in Germany, where it became an instant draw in its first exhibition in 1923. Even 3,000 years after her death, Nefertiti's allure still captivates tens of thousands of visitors each year. Encased in glass, it was her mysterious smile and powerful gaze that attracted me, making me wonder who she had been and how she'd become such a dominant figure in ancient Egypt. Now, the time is 1351 BCE. The great pharaohs of Egypt have included Khufu, Amos, and the female pharaoh Hatshepsut, while Ramses and Cleopatra are yet to come. Nefertiti is 15 years old, her sister is 13, and all of Egypt lies before them. Prologue. If you are to believe what the viziers say, then Amenhotep killed his brother for the crown of Egypt. In the third month of Akhet, Crown Prince Tutmosis lay in his room in Malkara Palace. A warm wind stirred the curtains of his chamber, carrying with it the desert scents of za'atar and myrrh. With each breeze, the long linens danced, wrapping themselves around the columns of the palace, brushing the sun-dappled tiles on the floor. But while the 20-year-old Prince of Egypt should have been riding to victory at the head of Pharaoh's charioteers, he was lying in his bedchamber, his right leg supported by cushions, swollen and crushed. The chariot that had failed him had immediately been burned, but the damage was done. His fever was high and his shoulders slumped. And while the jackal-headed god of death crept closer, Amenhotep sat across the room on a gilded chair, not even flinching when his older brother spat up the wine-colored phlegm that spelled possible death to the viziers. When Amenhotep couldn't stand any more of his brother's sickness, he stalked from the chamber and stood on a balcony overlooking Thebes. He crossed his arms over his golden pectoral, watching the farmers with their emmer wheat harvesting in the heavy heat of the day. Their silhouettes moved across the temples of Amun, his father's greatest contributions to the land. He stood above the city, thinking of the message that had summoned him from Memphis to his brother's side. And as the sun sank lower, he grew besieged by visions of what now might be. Amenhotep the Great, Amenhotep the Builder, Amenhotep the Magnificent. He could imagine it all. And it was only when a new moon had risen over the horizon that the sound of sandals slapping against tile made him turn. Your brother has called you back into his chamber.
Now?
Yes. Queen Ti turned her back on her son, and he followed her sharp footfalls into Tutmosis's chamber. Inside, the viziers of Egypt had gathered. Amenhotep swept the room with a glance. These were old men loyal to his father, men who had always loved his older brother more than him.
You may leave, he announced, and the viziers turned to the queen in shock.
You may go, she repeated. But when the old men were gone, she warned her son sharply, You will not treat the wise men of Egypt like slaves.
They are slaves. Slaves to the priests of Amun, who control more land and gold than we do.
If Tutmosis had lived to be crowned, he would have bowed to the priests like every pharaoh that came. Queen Ti's slap reverberated across the chamber. You will not speak that way while your brother is still alive. Amenhotep inhaled sharply and watched his mother move to Tutmosis's side. The queen caressed the prince's cheek with her hand. Her favorite son,
the one who was courageous in battle as well as life. They were so much alike, even sharing the same auburn hair and light eyes.
"Amenhotep is here to see you," she whispered, the braids from her wig brushing his face.
Tutmosis struggled to sit, and the queen moved to help him, but he waved her away.
"Leave us. We will talk alone."
Tee hesitated.
"It's fine," Tutmosis promised.
The two princes of Egypt watched their mother go, and only Anubis, who weighs the heart of the dead against the feather of truth, knows for certain what happened after the queen left that chamber. But there are many viziers who believe that when judgment comes, Amenhotep's heart will outweigh the feather. They think it has been made heavy with evil deeds, and that Amit, the crocodile god, will devour it, condemning him to oblivion for eternity. Whatever the truth, that night the crown prince, Tutmosis, died, and a new crown prince rose to take his place. Chapter 1, 1351 BCE. Pirit, season of growing. When the sun set over Thebes, splaying its last rays over the limestone cliffs, we walked in a long procession across the sand. In a twisting line that threaded between the hills, the viziers of Upper and Lower Egypt came first, then the priests of Amun, followed by hundreds of mourners. The sand cooled rapidly in the shadows. I could feel the grains between the toes of my sandals, and when the wind blew under my thin linen robe, I shivered. I stepped out of line so I could see the sarcophagus, carried on a sledge by a team of oxen so the people of Egypt would know how wealthy and great our crown prince had been. Nefertiti would be jealous that she'd had to miss this.
"I will tell her all about it when I get home," I thought, "if she is being nice to me."
The bald-headed priests walked behind our family, for we were even more important than the representatives of the gods. The incense they swung from golden balls made me think of giant beetles, stinking up the air whichever way they went. When the funeral procession reached the mouth of the valley, the rattling of the sistrum stopped, and the mourners went silent. On every cliff, families had gathered to see the prince, and now they looked down as the high priest of Amun performed the opening of the mouth to give Tutmosis back his senses in the afterlife. The priest was younger than the viziers of Egypt, but even so, men like my father stood back, deferring to his power when he touched a golden ankh to the mouth of the figure on the sarcophagus and announced, "The royal falcon has flown to heaven. Amenhotep the younger is arisen in his place." A wind echoed between the cliffs, and I thought I could hear the rush of the falcon's wings as the crown prince was freed from his body and ascended to the sky. There was a great amount of shuffling, children looking around the legs of their parents to see the new prince. I, too, craned my neck.
"Where is he?" I whispered. "Where is Amenhotep the younger?"
"In the tomb," my father replied. His bald head shone dully in the setting sun, and in the deepening of the shadows his face appeared hawkish.
"But doesn't he want the people to see him?" I asked.
"No, Senit," his word for little girl. "Not until he's been given what his brother was promised." I frowned.
"And what is that?"
He clenched his jaw. "The co-regency," he replied. When the ceremony was finished, soldiers spread out to stop commoners from following us into the valley, and our small party was expected to walk on alone. Behind us, the team of oxen heaved, pulling their golden cargo across the sand. Around us, cliffs rose against the darkening sky.
"We will be climbing," my father warned, and my mother paled slightly.
We were cats, she and I, frightened of places we couldn't understand,
valleys who sleep.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?